In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Can you hear me okay?
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. On this show, the topics of healthy boundaries, high character, and the human shadow have been examined in depth with guests such as Dr. Paul Dobransky, Paul Levy, Dr. Connie Zweig, and Dr. Joe Slate. I'm going to connect these ideas and show you how the healthy mind-body-spirit concept applies directly when assessing the health of a person's boundary and human energy field. Beginning with boundaries, past guest author and psychiatrist Dr. Paul Dobransky is one of very few who developed a comprehensive visual system to understand and utilize a healthy human boundary and explain that connection to achieving high character. He says your identity in life depends upon learning about boundaries. By doing so, you can learn how to be free from stress and how to command respect. Essentially, making decisions out of courage, meaning doing the right thing at the time that it's needed, is making a decision out of courage. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to be hypervigilant and run around performing acts of heroism. Being mindful and keeping your word, such as showing up at the right time or being prepared for a meeting, are some everyday examples. Standing up for yourself in an assertive way and learning how to say no are other examples. In our interviews, Dr. Paul explained the importance of saying no to maintain healthy human boundaries and keep the energy exchange in the win-win category. Taking win-lose deals will over time empty your tank of self-esteem. Stop taking the win-lose deals by answering no to those requests. Saying no is closing the visualized door in your boundary wall. As Dr. Paul describes it, your boundary wall has a door, or many doors, but it's important to visualize the handle attached on the inside of the door so you control the opening and closing. When you have the control of the door and only accept win-win deals, in addition to making decisions out of courage, you build your self-esteem. Your self-esteem is a combination of well-being and confidence. That's your gold, which Dr. Carl Jung refers to when speaking about the psychological condition of the human shadow. How can you be free from stress utilizing a healthy boundary? Many who are aware of their shadow issues and potential to lose composure under stress have developed a system of pausing before responding to stimuli. This is a similar teaching covered in some martial arts, military, and police training. Keeping your composure in a high-stress environment is usually a sign of high character. A person with a healthy boundary can choose to respond or not, since the handle of the boundary doors are on the inside. It's a simple yet effective visual tool that can help fortify your self-esteem and reduce stress. Unhealthy boundaries can be full of holes or can be walled off. A walled-off boundary seals up the doors to protect from stimuli such as stress, people, or a hostile environment. The impervious boundary is often deployed by those emotionally or psychologically hurt, or if someone has experienced loss. In these cases, stress can crash through and overwhelm the person. This is often why psychiatrists will prescribe antidepressants as a temporary fix while you learn to build a proper boundary. In a walled-off boundary, no decisions were being made. Therefore, self-esteem levels remained very low. Low self-esteem can result in projecting that loss or hurt onto others. This is also where the shadow manifests, creating irrational or unprovoked negative thoughts, lashing out, name-calling, and violent acts toward others. We hear part of an interview with Dr. Paul Dobransky speaking about boundaries and psychic vampires.
Well, some of the ways, other ways of thinking about boundaries are that it operates as a shield. If you thought of medieval times, how somebody could get into a fight, he'd have a sword and a shield. And if you use your sword, that burns all your energy up. But if you just put up a shield, you block other people's attacks. So our boundary is a shield against stress. And stress is just negative emotional energy. it's simultaneously, though, like a tank, like a tank of our fuel. And one of the ways of thinking of our emotional fuel is that's self-esteem. There are two varieties of self-esteem that I talk about. So it's both a shield and a tank. It's a container.
I'm glad you brought up the defending yourself part, because on this show we often talk about energy vampires and, mm-hmm. and things like that. And we tried to understand what's going on psychologically with past guest Dr. Joe Slate and others, even Matthew Deleuze. What's going on with people who you're near, they would drain your energy and mm-hmm. things like that. Is there a scientific explanation for this?
Sure. In fact, I had a mentor in psychiatry in medical school, kind of turned me on to doing psychiatry as a specialty, and he was an anthropologic psychiatrist. I thought it was one of the most unusual things I had ever heard of, that he spent a lot of his life's work studying vampire and zombie myths in world cultures. And at first glance, that sounds kind of like Abraham Lincoln, vampire hunter, or something, you know, very out there. But it's legitimate science, a legitimate academic endeavor for him. What he determined is that vampire and zombie myths exist in all world cultures, even if they have no connection to other cultures throughout all history, because they evolve as a way of teaching a society about what pathologic narcissism is. And that's really what vampires mean symbolically, pathologic narcissism.
You're really you're taking the fun out of the vampire mythology. But I kind of understand what you're saying. It's a condition where just something's not right. And you had pointed out earlier that it's a young person in an adult's body.
Let's make it fun and scary again then. It's very, very real. I mean, if you talk to people in the process of divorcing, that's very real and very scary and very painful. And blood is symbolic of a kind of life energy. It's life force. So this concept of a vampire, an emotional vampire, or a pathologic narcissist, to psychiatrists, that's how we talk about this, it's somebody who drains your emotional energy, which is very real, very scary. You're exhausted being around this kind of person. They literally do drain you, even though it's invisible and it's not blood. It is your life force. It's your energy. It's your self-esteem. Your self-esteem is being sucked away for real mm-hmm. by a person. Mm-hmm. So it's even scarier than a horror movie. It's real.
Right, where you could at least see the blood and try to stop the bleeding. You
right.
can't even see it.
Right.
But if you know your work and you understand the boundaries maybe in your material, you could feel it happening. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very subjective thing. You know, if you don't notice what's happening and one day you get a wake-up call, you're in a relationship that you didn't even realize that you've lost your sense of self. It's become codependent. Or you're in a toxic workplace where the boss is a bully and you came in all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed on your first day of work, and then a year later you're this sullen, depressing person. You're like, oh my God, what happened to me? Well, you've been a victim of a pathologic narcissist.
That's fascinating.
An emotional vampire.
That's amazing.
Bullying.
It's bullying.
Bullying is a big, big topic, and it's not new. It's been around forever, and it's kind of what pathologic narcissists do. Vampires, they're bullies.
The opposite of that, when you're around somebody who makes you feel good, what's going on there in terms of the boundary dynamic?
Well, being around, it's almost like a definition of friendship. You know, my second book for women was about women's friendships with each other. And as I was trying to lay out, you know, my personal definition based in science of what that would look like, it has four variables. And then simultaneously, I was looking for, you know, are there any ancient philosophers that talked about friendship? And I actually could only find one, Aristotle. I forget what exactly his terms were, but they were so similar. Friendship is consistent mutual shared positive emotion. Consistent meaning what you see is what you get. It's always going to be that way. Most of the time, it's going to be that way. A person keeps their word. They say they're going to show up to help you move. They show up to help you move. It's mutual, meaning it's a two-way street. It's win-win. It's not always you leaning on that on them and them always leaning on you. It's both of you doing that, 50-50. It's shared, meaning if your friend that you just met moves across country, well, what are you going to do together? You have to do things together for a friendship to exist. And then the most important terminology of all is positive emotion. You can't have a friendship based just on complaining or negativity and this sort of thing. It'll dissolve eventually. So that's one example of, you know, being around a positive person who is your equal, your peer. We call that a friend. And what we share with each other is love or friendship. They're the same thing. It's shared positive emotion.
You go into detail about the currencies of the four currencies mm-hmm. and how those are important in the exchange in a relationship or a friendship or an intimate or business or things like that,
sure.
those types of relationships. But if that's not there, you get static, or if you're in a intimate relationship and the boundaries have dissolved and you're sharing all these things and there's a breakup,
mm-hmm.
what happens there?
Well, the natural course of, say, a codependent relationship where one or both people are kind of narcissistic.
Codependent, right? That's what it's called.
Codependence, what the natural course is, there's mutual bullying, so to speak, that's going on. The boundary between the two people breaks down, and it can create an illusion that feels, at first, really, really good. And we call that intimacy. I mean, when we know somebody intimately, it means we have full access to everything they are, how they feel. We have shared feelings, shared ideas. We feel bonded to each other, and it feels great. But if a couple or two friends or business partners, whoever it is, can't sometimes put up a boundary again and close the door on each other on areas they disagree with each other on, agree to disagree,
right.
then eventually one or the other person in this permanent intimacy starts kind of bullying the other, and then the best one wins. They start acquiring all the resources in the relationship. It becomes all about them, always benefiting them, and not the other person, until finally the one that acquires all the resources, the relationship, says, oh, wow, I feel full. Thank you. See you later. We're going to part ways. And then there's a winner and a loser. And somebody goes off with less than what they had before.
And the material in that boundary, that's more than just self-esteem.
It's self-esteem. It's your time. It may be your money. It's your energy, your passion, your spirit, your humor, your information, your education, all these parts to you. There's an invisible economy. You were talking about, you know, what are the currencies of this silent interpersonal economy that goes on between people. Well, both lawyers and judges will describe what they call a person legally. A person is an entity with cognitive, emotional, and volitional capacity. And all that means is somebody has intellectual ability and data. We're exchanging data right now, so that's one currency, learning. Second is emotion or happiness. A third is freedom, decision-making capacity. That's volition. Okay, so I borrowed from, you know, the legal terminology of what a person is, cognitive, emotional, and volitional capacity.
I wonder where you got that. It's time-tested
mm-hmm.
and in court, and these are the currencies of and dynamics of being in a relationship. Was love in this as well?
Yeah, love is a synonym for happiness or self-esteem. They're all positive emotional energy. Love, friendship, happiness, self-esteem. They're the same thing.
You had also talked about things like karma and how that's scientifically measurable.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a brief understanding of that?
Yeah, you remember the film A Beautiful Mind about John Nash and the Nash equilibrium from game theory and economics? I think some of his work is basically a mathematical proof of karma. That's what he did. That's why he got a Nobel Prize. It's a mathematical proof of karma. At first, if you are a shark and take advantage of people and bully people and you're a narcissist, you're a vampire, you'll overpower people quickly and you'll win in the short term. You're kind of a con artist kind of person. You'll win in the short term, but eventually society will catch on to you, punish you, and then you're done. The opposite of that is somebody who's kind of a milquetoast, somebody that's easily taken advantage of. They lose right away. You know, you give your lunch money away to other people, to bullies. But the proper way to navigate this kind of interaction is halfway between the two. Have a boundary where every interaction with other people ought to be fair, generally, and equitable, and win-win. So the Nash equilibrium, John Nash, talked about win-win versus win-lose interactions, and only win-win interactions are going to be durable as a connection between people.
What we're talking about here may seem obvious to some people who naturally understand it, but not everyone has these structures and systems running unconsciously. Some people have to work on this.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you take that win-lose all the time?
Well, then you are being a dependent person. You're the kind of person that your way of making your way in life is going to be your strategy at trying to win the lotto. You're waiting for magic to happen to save you in life. You're looking for a parent, essentially. And so you've got a lot of growing to do, you know, if you're in that state. Now, at the same time, a lot of people get a lot of gratification feeling like a parent to people. If they're kind of a caretaking type of person, there's a lot of gratification they get out of the mothering role to others. It makes them feel great. But in the end, you know, if everybody's not following the golden rule, then it doesn't work so well. Everybody has to follow the golden rule for it to work.
I gotcha. Okay. And you're talking about spoiling your children. Is that what the mothering instinct? Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that when a person does a lot of parentalism toward others, there's a lot of personal gratification they can get out of that. It's a high that they get.
I understand.
But it needs to not be their only way of feeling good about who they are.
Do you come across that scenario a lot in your work in treating patients?
Sure. People that, you know, overly caretake others and enable others and are codependent. Oh, yeah. Sure.
That was an excerpt from an interview with Dr. Paul Dobransky. And this is without going deep into the various archetype work that Dr. Paul has written about in his book, The King, Warrior, Magician, and Lover. In one interview, Dr. Paul was also pointing out how experience stress can be very damaging to the point where a regression takes place and the personality can revert to a younger psychological age. This bit of information isn't very well known. Think about this for a minute. The improvements gained from years of therapy sessions, personal education, or various critical life-shaping experiences can dissolve when you repeatedly expose your nervous system to stressful thoughts or situations. Protections against this level of stress can occur with a healthy personal boundary. Low self-esteem can also occur from constantly taking lose-lose deals. You're saying yes to every request that's asked of you. The doors to access your personal gold are left wide open. Another way to think about this condition is that the door handles are wrongly placed on the outside where anyone can open them up and then reach in and take what they want. A lot of the time, this is done unconsciously. The results are low self-esteem. You're feeling drained and psychically tired. Psychic fatigue is a mind-body tiredness that past guest Carissa Conti writes about because it's usually the result of energy being transferred to a psychic parasite. Past guest Dr. Joe Slate went into detail about this, and so did Dr. Paul. The indigenous wisdom traditions also point out that on the physical level, drugs and alcohol create holes in the human auric field that allow easy access to etheric parasites and psychic vampires. Not unlike how the mountain pine beetle can detect a weak tree to infest, etheric parasites can spot a weak human energy system. Dr. Joe Slate is the author of Psychic Vampires, Protection from Energy Predators and Parasites. He's a licensed psychologist with a PhD from the University of Alabama and postdoctoral studies in hypnosis and psychosomatic medicine at the University of California. His research into human energy systems has been funded by the U.S. Army and the Parapsychological Foundation of New York. We listen now to an excerpt with an interview with Dr. Joe Slade.
I had a former student. She had just completed her degree in personnel psychology and was being interviewed by a personnel manager for a business position. Well, during the interview, she began to notice this fatigue, this slowing of her mental functions during the interview, and she thought, I'm certainly not at my best in this interview. And then she began to realize that she was the victim of a vampire attack. Although the interviewer had no idea, probably, that such an attack was underway. But then she began to realize, you know, I can correct this. I can reverse what is happening here. And she used a technique that she learned in my class called the finger interlock technique. It's sort of a dramatic technique, but it can be done in an instance, and it envelops your body in a protective shield. And so she used that, took command of the interview. The whole situation totally changed, and she was rewarded with an offer for the position. So there are things that we can do. And a part of that finger interlock technique, incidentally, is described in the book. It takes only seconds to implement, and our studies using electrophotography showed that it does erect a shield, a protective shield, around your own personal energy system. I considered that one of the most important findings of our research, and it's available. It's very simple. It's available to anyone who might feel that they're being victimized by energy vampirism.
What an amazing example, that, and she got the job. But that
yes,
also
she did. In fact, she was given an offer beyond that she even expected. I would be glad to run you through this little technique right quickly, Jeff, if you would like. It's so simple and yet so effective. I found in the study of complex phenomena, complexity seeks simplicity. Now, I can't explain why that's the case, but we found very complex psychological and parapsychological phenomena. Always, when you boil it down, they're very simple concepts involved, and the empowering approach to deal with those things is usually quite simple. In the finger interlock technique, you simply join your thumb and middle finger, the tips of each hand, to make two circles. Then you bring the hands together to interlock those circles, so you have the finger interlock. Then you simply mentally use the affirmation, I am protected and fully empowered. And that's all you have to do. Instantly, you assume command of situations, social interactions that otherwise could become more or less vampiristic in their nature.
And one of the hallmarks of that was fatigue, and her mental processes were breaking down a little
right.
bit. You point out in the book there's a spectrum of psychic vampirism, from maybe this is somewhere in the lower ranges, but in the higher ranges, how severe is it for the victim?
Well, the fact of the matter is, in his higher ranges, you have the energy vampire who develops a dependency on the energy system of another individual. The psychic vampire, typically, whether male or female, has a weak energy or undeveloped energy system. And so they have learned to rely on the energy system of other people around them to maintain their energy supply. Now, that's a sad dilemma to find oneself in. So while the psychic vampire may not be aware of that, it nevertheless becomes a powerful force in social interactions, and there's no winner. The victim becomes disempowered by the loss of energy. The vampire becomes disempowered by increased dependency on the energy of another person. And so there are ways of correcting that. And in my writing on this topic and our research studies that backed it up, we found there are ways that the vampire can empower oneself and their ways of the victim also using similar techniques to achieve a state of empowerment. So that's what the book is all about. It isn't to condemn the vampire. I mean, what's to be gained by saying, oh, the vampire is an evil person, or to condemn the victim by being so vulnerable to the vampire? It's just a characteristic that exists in social interactions for almost everyone to some degree. If you think back, Jeff, you may recall a situation in which you just became increasingly fatigued as the interaction wore on. That could be a form of energy transfer, which we could label vampirism. It's certainly an energy type, has nothing to do with the blood type of fictional vampirism. It's just a characteristic that we all experience.
You notice that Dr. Joe Slade has a compassion for the energy parasites because of the energy exchange relativity. The technique he mentions of clasping the hands together is very effective. You can look at it as closing the circuit. However, on a deeper level, you become the target of energy vampires and etheric parasites if your energy system is running low, either from a combination of unhealthy boundaries, a lifetime of lose-lose decisions, and the body being nutritionally deficient. In past shows, Laura Shapira and Dr. Connie Zweig discussed various aspects of Dr. Carl Jung's psychological theory of the human shadow as critical components of ourselves to acknowledge, because if unrecognized, the human shadow begins to grow and evolve on its own, unconsciously, and will usually show up in situations under stress. Dr. Zweig and Laura Shapira also say this is the moment to recognize some of your own buried treasure. Why is understanding the shadow aspect of your personality important for a healthy human boundary and overall human energy system? If this exploration is suppressed, your hidden treasure could remain buried. Dr. Connie Zweig, founder of the Center for Shadow Work and Spiritual Counseling at AIWP, she has a doctorate in psychology, 2 years training at the L.A. Jung Institute, and has been in practice for 20 years. Her books include Meeting the Shadow, The Hidden Power of the Dark Side of Human Nature, and Romancing the Shadow, Illuminating the Dark Side of the Soul. Dr. Zweig has come to be known as the shadow expert. We hear an excerpt from past guest Dr. Connie Zweig about the human shadow in the context of relationships. Let's go back to Robert Bly's book, and I'm so glad that you referenced it in that interview with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove. That was really interesting. I didn't know he wrote this book. It really is amazing. And there's an excerpt in there about projection in a marriage. And he writes, "It's threatening when the projection starts to rattle. Let's suppose a woman has put a giant's mask firmly on her husband's face and feels it as a painful relief. At least she gets it out of her psyche. But what if her husband fails one day to be a negative patriarch? What to do then? Trouble. She might, unconsciously, of course, overdraw her checking account, lose bills, dent the fender, feel victimized, act like a little girl. That may turn him into a tyrant again, or she may go into a feminist meeting to get revved up. Hopefully, someone there will explain that even men's kindness are a subtle part of their oppression. When she gets home, he has the patriarch mask on again." Can you explain what Robert Bly is talking about?
Yeah, you know, Robert, when he wrote that book, was very involved in developing the men's movement. And so he was very concerned about projections onto men of dark power, because he was wrestling with the consequences of that in these men. So what he was saying is that in a lot of couples, women project a kind of power onto their partners that the men are not really carrying, that it's in the women's minds. And it comes from their fathers, particularly. It could come from teachers or priests or other male figures, but mostly from their fathers. And for a certain amount of time, when people get together, a projection fits. So, for example, she projects the power onto him and he projects the powerlessness onto her, and they have a match. and he's in charge, and she's accommodating, and she follows him, and he makes the decisions, right? And so they are enacting each other's projections. And it looks for a while like it's a good relationship. And then one of two things happens. Either he doesn't want all that responsibility anymore and he wants a full partner, or she starts to feel her own power and is no longer satisfied with her subordinate position. And so the projection rattles. Because it rattles because that little fit that they've made is no longer working. And either how he sees her starts to shift or how she sees him starts to shift. And at that point, they need to uncover the old patterns and try to build a new dynamic. Otherwise, the relationship falls apart. If people only see this outwardly, if they only see it as roles, which is how most people see it, that's why we have, you know, more than 50% divorce rate. It's not roles. It's internal. It's internal shadow figures being projected onto the other person. And when the person no longer carries that projection, the whole thing falls apart.
And you're suggesting going back to the original role to resolve what it had broken down.
It's often in that situation, because we're in a patriarchal culture, that the woman starts to become empowered and then the whole thing starts to fall apart. But what I'm suggesting is that that's the time for inner work. When the equilibrium that they've established starts to shake, and you look at each other, each of them looks at the other and says, who the hell am I with? Who are you? You're not the person I married. Then there's an incredible opportunity there for growth and development. It doesn't have to be the end of the marriage at that point.
That was part of an interview with Dr. Connie Zweig, and you can hear that it's very complicated, and the shadow is operating on the unconscious level. And there's a masculine shadow and a feminine shadow. Females can have masculine shadows, and men can have feminine shadows. In 1917, Dr. Carl Jung wrote the essay, quote, "On the Psychology of the Unconscious," about the personal shadow as the other in us, the negative side of the personality, the sum of all unpleasant qualities we like to hide. It embarrasses us or shames us. Quote, "Everything with a substance casts a shadow. The ego stands to the shadow as light to shade." Past guest Lori Shapira is a teacher at the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. She's also a filmmaker and author of the book The Cassandra Complex. We talked about the various manifestations of the shadow personality.
I was thinking that that vulnerability in human beings is something certainly to be exploited by those people who would know about this particular quality of humans, where the projection of shadows could be exploited. And I think it is.
In terms of exploiting the projections of the shadow, people in power could create fear that those bad people out there are going to get you unless you do what I tell you to do. We see that all the time.
There are a number of documentaries that investigate that type of exploitation, a lot of criticism on the war on terror and these
exactly.
types of things.
Homeland security, you know, surveilling our phone calls and emails could be seen in that light. I mean, it's a very slippery slope. It's a very tricky proposition.
And within all of this, the government and the agenda is constantly caught in lies and deception, mm-hmm. and it's constantly being exposed, which is another major shadow aspect on their part.
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing that I wanted to make a point of is that there are two kinds of shadow. There is personal shadow, and there is collective more archetypal kind of shadow. Personal shadow derives from your family of origin, from your childhood, maybe parts of you that your mother and father don't like and would like for you to suppress and repress, which then drives those parts of you into the shadow, so that it's very hard for you to live out your wholeness, live out your true self. Now, in terms of the collective shadow, groups have a shadow. Nations have a shadow. Religious groups have a shadow. Ethnic groups have a shadow. Civilizations have a shadow. One thing that I have personally found to be very interesting, and it is sort of the subject of the last film that I made, is the shadow of Western civilization. One way to look at the shadow of a group is you juxtapose their ideals, their ego ideals, over and against the shadow of those ideals. Let's say we look at America, American ideals. I mean, we would like to see ourselves as the guardians of democracy in the world. So what's the shadow of that? Well, we've become power mongers. Our concept of ourself is very inflated.
Would terrorists be the shadow aspect of the guardians of democracy?
That would be the projection. The projection of the shadow of the guardians of democracy. Because we're the good guys. We wear the white hats. So the terrorists are the bad guys. But the qualities of the terrorists, if we look at ourselves, we see that we are terrorists. Here we've got two different concepts put together. We've got the shadow of our being the guardians of democracy, but we also are projecting it. But we know that shadow manifests not only in projection, but it also manifests in actions. Actions that we say we're not doing. And, you know, which goes to your idea of the lies and deceptions. Are they lies and deceptions when the government is caught with their pants down? Are they lying or are they really unconscious?
We've had on past guests talking about lies, and we've had on Dr. Brad Blanton, who wrote a book called Radical Honesty, and he talked about the most pernicious lie was withholding truth. We find through investigative journalism that the government often is found withholding truth. That's a very interesting shadow aspect.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind with that is like Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. Was that a conscious lie originally, which got disseminated? I mean, where does a lie leave off and a not knowing come in? Who knew, who didn't know?
So these are very strong examples of the archetype shadow, the collective shadow, which manifests within civilizations, countries, and religions, as you pointed out, and groups and institutions. What other archetype examples do you have?
Well, to stay with the shadow of America, we also like to see ourselves as the compassionate upholders of human rights. So what's the shadow of that? A holier-than-thou attitude. Another manifestation of the shadow in our world would be the pedophile priests in the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, which has given rise to these horrific, abuses of children, it makes sense in a horrible kind of a way, because to need to be a spiritual paragon of virtue, it doesn't leave any room for reality, for the body, for the needs of the body. You know, taking a vow of chastity and acting out in such a horrific and dark way. An interesting juxtaposition. I mean, most religions fall prey to some kind of a shadow problem. Evangelical ministers who have either been found to be doing financial mischief or having affairs with this and that. Political figures who create their own sort of destruction. It's rampant in our culture, with a lot of positive projections then falling prey. I mean, one of the things one can say about shadow is what shines the brightest creates the darkest shadow. Another ideal that we hold is personal individual freedom. That's something that America and Western civilization has really developed, is individual freedom. Well, there's a lot of shadow to that. I mean, then what about the group? It seems that Eastern civilization has developed along the line of group consciousness more than we have. So what's the shadow of developing the notion of personal and individual freedom? Greed, egotism, narcissism. I mean, narcissism is the disease of our culture.
That was Lori Shapira, teacher at the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. Some people don't want to talk about evil or even think about evil. Remember Mark Passio's interview about the New Age philosophy of never getting angry. Mark says you need anger for the transmutation process. The human shadow will target those who ignore its ancient psycho-spiritual disease of the soul. Author Paul Levy calls it Watiko. It's another name for the same affliction of the shadow. Paul's book, Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil, claims by realizing that we're all capable of terrible evil unwittingly or not is a beginning to dissolve its strength. Paul had a life-changing spiritual awakening and began to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. Let's go now to some of that interview. How would you suggest to someone listening right now ways in which they could recognize the Watiko influence or manifestation in their life?
Well, I mean, there are three ways. There are probably a lot more than three, but there are three that I kind of talk about. And they're all the same in a way. They're all aspects of the same deeper, you know, sort of energy. And because I think about in my life when what was happening in my family. So here my father, to give an example, was a very sick man and was playing out this, you know, he was acting out his unconscious and just playing out his stuff and just acting that without any consciousness. And I was in the role of the one who was not only the recipient of it, but had some form of awareness and was trying to point at it or shed light on it. And what I couldn't believe was how the entire family system, not only my mother, but the relatives, but then once mental health psychiatrists came in, they played this role too, that the whole field, the whole family system actually configured to protect the abuser. And, you know, and I didn't realize at the time because I was so young, but this is typical. Like, I became the identified patient, you know, which means I was the one in the family system who was seen to be the sick one. But it was like the whole field, like I was saying, configured to protect the abuser. And that's when I began to realize, oh, my God, there's like a higher dimensional process that's informing what's playing out. It was, in physics, they talk about the field is this non-local energy. It doesn't play by the rules of third dimensional space and time. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, of those three, the first one is seeing the field. When you begin to realize, oh, wow, actually everything that's happening there, it's all like, you know, interconnected in a certain way, that it's not separate and that it's contained within and expressions of this deeper non-local field. And so that would be the first way of seeing it. But going along with that is then you begin to realize, oh, well, once I see the field, that makes me realize that we're actually not separate from each other, that I'm not separate from you, and I'm interconnected and interdependent with you, and that you actually don't exist as an isolated, independent entity either, but you exist, you have relationship to other beings who are also, who don't have a fixed reference point, and we're all interconnected and interdependent. That's the snap out of the spell of the separate self, and that's to realize, wow, we're all actually interconnected and interdependent. And the expression of that is compassion. So that's the second of the three aspects. And the third, which goes along with number one and two, is to see the dreamlike nature of reality, that this is, you know, I just finished a book on quantum physics, and I talk about that. What quantum physics is pointing at is that there's no objective reality, but on the contrary, the act of observing the reality actually changes the reality we're observing, i.e. the observer is the observed. What I've just described, that's exactly the nature of a dream. You know, when you're in a dream, if you change your perception, the dream instantaneously shapeshifts to reflect back our change in perception, because the dream is nothing other than our own mind appearing to us. That's our nature. That's the nature of our situation right now. So it's those three things, seeing the non-local field, having the realization we're not separate, and seeing the dreamlike nature, that when you actually, you know, are accessing those viewpoints or that realization, that helps you to stabilize and be able to see Watiko. And once you see it, it can't, like a vampire, it can't stand to be seen because it takes away its power.
How long is the process of dissolving Watiko after you reach the point of understanding the dream state nature of reality?
Yeah, well, it never ends. It's an ongoing process. It's not like, oh, somebody sees it, and then if I think, oh, I've seen Watiko, now I can just rest, well, guess what? At that moment, I've fallen under its spell. Because the point is, we all have Watiko in potential. It exists in the collective unconscious of our species. If I say, oh, that person has Watiko, you know, and I don't, well, the bug feeds off of polarization. So by me saying that, then I'm actually unwittingly, with the best of intentions, I'm reinforcing and feeding the very virus that I'm actually trying to heal. So it's important to understand, on the one hand, we all have it, which means at any moment, any of us can fall under its spell. And think about it. Who among us hasn't fallen into their unconscious and acted out their unconscious? We all have. I mean, that's what Christ was saying when he said something like, who can cast the first stone? The idea being that we've all sinned. You know, we've all fallen asleep at given moments. So it's not just like, oh, now I've seen it, and now, I mean, like I'm trying to say, if I feel like now I've seen it, and now I'm, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't fall under its spell anymore, well, guess what? You just have. So the point is to develop that mindfulness, humility, and compassion, and in a sense, that immunizes, you know, and the open heart, the empathic open heart. All of that serves as an inoculation from Watiko.
I was wondering about the use of psychological drugs such as antidepressants and other elements in our society that could suppress the awakening of seeing Watiko.
Well, the thing is this, you know, like, for example, I have a real charge around pharmaceutical drugs, because when I was having my spiritual awakening, which was a full-blown spiritual awakening, you know, I got misdiagnosed. This was in 81, you know, and I was told, oh, you have this chemical imbalance, which, you know, has then come out, you know, decades later. They've confessed, you know, psychiatric big pharma has confessed, oh, that was just completely made up and bogus. You know, the pharmaceutical companies just made that up to sell more drugs, to make more money. So I'm the last person in the world to want anybody to take any sort of pharmaceutical drugs. But that being said, they can be helpful for certain people at certain moments if the suffering is just too intense, and it can help them to really get through hard times.
Right.
But they have incredibly destructive, these long-term effects. It's really about getting people hooked on them so that they become consumers of the drugs for the rest of their lives and spend a ton of money. You know, they don't even know the long-term side effects of a lot of these drugs. You know, I would just counsel people, yeah, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm just saying in this unilateral way, no, they're just bad. No, they can be really helpful. but to, you know, to use them with real caution, because they can incredibly get in the way of connecting with our deeper awakening. They can create like this anesthesia in the psyche where we become numb to our feelings, and then we're not really able to deal with the deeper emotional process that's informing our being upset.
In Chapter 8, titled Evil, you write about some of your readers who objected to the use of the word evil. The word triggered something inside them which made them feel uncomfortable. You ask, is there something being revealed to us because it's a trigger, and do we need the homeopathic dose? Can you talk about that in context of the current criticism within classroom environments and that prevent professors to teach certain topics because of trigger words such as rape?
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, it makes me think, like I had a dream one time, and in the dream I was lucid in the dream to whatever degree I was. So I was going up to my dream characters, you know, who were just aspects of myself, and I was, in my excitement, was telling them, oh, hey, guess what? This is all a dream. We're dreaming. And one of them, I'll never forget this, he was like, you know, could you use another word? I have, like, a charge around that word, and I just have bad associations around the word dream, and could you choose another word? So here I am, and I'm in a dream, and I'm realizing it's a dream, and I'm saying to other people it's a dream, and they're saying, oh, please don't use that word. And it's like a similar conundrum you find. And I talk about this in my latest book, that evil, there's no better word to describe the incredible destruction that's being enacted. Like, that word was coined with a particular meaning. And I totally understand that it's a trigger word. That word like that, somebody hears it and they immediately get triggered. And, you know, what typically people do is, oh, well, just if you don't use that word, then I won't be triggered, then I'll feel better. But I would like to offer to them, well, what in you is being touched in your process of being triggered? What about if you put your attention there and see it as an opportunity to inquire into the charge that just got activated by the mere mention of the word evil, as compared to like, oh, stop mentioning that word and then I won't be triggered? That just seems backwards and upside down. And so I think it's really important. It's a moral need of our species to find the right words for our experience. And it also brings up the fact that in mainstream culture, they can, you know, it's easy for the powers that be to control our perceptions and our thinking by making these limitations on what we're allowed to talk about. Oh, we can't, that can't be part of the dialogue. Oh, we can't use that word. Oh, you can't think about that. Oh, you're not allowed to perceive in that way. And it's all part of the programming, the conditioning, the brainwashing, the hypnosis that we all go through. It's like we're being put under a spell, and the spell is of massive proportions. It's a collective spell, and the mainstream media is the major propaganda organ of the powers that be. So, I just really feel strongly that it's super important for us to find the right word. And that's why even in my book, I talk about the importance of finding the word Watiko, that I'm not attached to that's the word we use. Every wisdom tradition has their own word for what the natives call Watiko. But it's important to find a word that has like a meaning to us. And, you know, just one final thing, like in a fairy tale or a myth, if there's like a demon, they always point at that once you find the demon's name, and it can't just be any name, it has to be the right name, the proper name. Once you find the right name of the demon, it takes away its power. And the same way, we have this need to be able to like find the language and find the words, and how do you make a word, you spell it, to find the words that actually create the counterspell. That's why, the title of my book is Dispelling the Curse of Evil, you know, and so it's super important for us to be able to, you know, to be able to speak the right word for what our experience is.
That was part of an interview with past guest Paul Levy, author of Dispelling Watiko, Breaking the Curse of Evil. Paul says encoded in the very same affliction that will destroy us from the inside out is a process that can empower and wake us up. But if you can't recognize that, it hides itself from being seen. It will continue to operate in sinister ways. Past guest Professor Eric Larson, who gave me his copy of Dispelling Watiko, wrote a powerful essay on this book. The shadow, or Watiko doesn't have power on its own. It operates through the unconscious in the psychic blind spot and manifesting as projections. Paul's research found that the Watiko virus won't mutate. It forces us to mutate. Paul Levy is also the author of The Madness of George W. Bush, a reflection of our collective psychosis, and also Awakened by Darkness, When Evil Becomes Your Father. Boundaries and shadow work also scale up and apply to businesses, corporations, or countries. Remember what Dr. Joe Slate said about location being irrelevant. In physics, it's called the non-local field. There's no separation anywhere. The third-dimensional laws of space and time are transcended. They don't hold. Everything is connected with everything else. Paul Levy says, when we think, that bad guy, that terrorist, etc., they're evil, we've fallen under the spell of Watiko. What Watiko feeds off of, not only fear, but polarization. If we think that someone is evil, that's the way the Watiko is hiding within our perception. When you see those non-local fields, then you begin to see the dreamlike nature of reality. You realize we don't exist in isolation. We're interdependent with each other. We all exist in this web, this reciprocal interconnection. When you see that, that's the snap out of the separate self. The expression out of the realization is compassion. Compassion is the Watiko dissolver. Healthy human boundaries, opening the door for win-win deals. High character, making decisions out of courage, and an awareness of the human shadow, or Watiko, transforming the darkness into gold, are all connected and forming part of the formula in maintaining the human energy system. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the